And I've always been amazed also at how many other military people that were involved in the 1947 incident stayed in Roswell after they got out of the military. The article that Walter wrote had the headline in the Roswell Daily Record on July 8, 1947. I mentioned earlier that the Air Force would issue four excuses for what happened in Roswell during the 60 years since the incident happened. This newspaper headline, written by Walter Haut, under the approval and instruction of a United States Army Air Force base commander, Colonel Blanchard, was the first excuse. We had captured a flying saucer in our possession. These were without doubt busy days with extremely high security on the base and the surrounding areas of Roswell until the military and the government could get a handle on the situation. Young local mortician Glenn Dennis was employed at Ballard Funeral Home in Roswell at the time of the incident. Glenn's involvement has been reported hundreds of times in books and documentaries, and although it basically is the same each time, researchers have raised many questions over the years about his involvement and his method of handling that involvement. On July 5th, Glenn said he received phone calls from the funeral home, at the funeral home, from the base asking about the chemicals required in embalming fluid and what effect bodies exposed to the elements would have on body tissue, stomach contents, etc. He was also called and asked how many hermetically sealed children's caskets he had in stock at the funeral home. According to Glenn, he took an injured airman out to the base in the funeral home ambulance who had been injured in a vehicle accident in town. Ballard Funeral Home had a contract with a military base for ambulance service and funerals. When he arrived at the base infirmary, he noticed metal debris in the back of several Army ambulances parked at the rear entrance to the base hospital. He asked questions when he got inside the hospital, assuming there had been a plane crash, and was threatened by a 6'2" red-headed captain, basically being told, if you go into town and spread any rumors, they'll be finding your bones out in the sand. He also saw a nurse that he knew very well coming out of a storeroom with her face covered, nauseated, who told him to get out of here before you get in trouble. The next day, at the nurse's request, Glenn met the nurse at the officers' club, where she explained that she had been involved with a pathologist taking notes during the examination of bodies. She described the beings to him, and according to Glenn Dennis, she drew a picture of an alien hand and face on the back of a prescription pad and gave it to him. According to Glenn, the nurse was suddenly shipped out the next day, supposedly to Europe, where shortly thereafter it was reported she had been killed in a plane crash. There is no record of a plane crash. Mr. Dennis, because he says he made a solemn oath to the nurse to not reveal her name, has not revealed it in some 60 years. He did, however, send two well-known researchers on a wild goose chase for over 5 years for the wrong name. When questioned about the drawing given him by the nurse, he stated he misplaced it or lost it. You can imagine the importance of these two pieces of evidence in trying to help resolve the Roswell incident, the piece of paper and the name of the nurse, which thus far Glenn has not satisfactorily explained to any researcher. Many of Mr. Dennis's other claims pertaining to who he knew and how he was involved are also being seriously investigated. We've also never located the red-headed captain and others he mentioned, so that investigation continues. But things apparently progressing expediently at Roswell Army Airfield pertaining to secrecy, crating, and loading the debris and bodies up for shipment out of New Mexico, General Roger Ramey, in charge of 8th Air Force Headquarters in Fort Worth, Texas, which Roswell Army Airfield was under, summoned Major Marcel, the intelligence officer I mentioned earlier, to Fort Worth to some of the debris, so Ramey could see it and make a public announcement. If, in fact, there was a meeting in Roswell at the base that morning with General Ramey, as Walter Haut had indicated, why was it necessary for Major Marcel to fly the debris to Fort Worth that same day for Ramey to see it? Perhaps that was part of the cover-up decided on at the earlier meeting, so General Ramey could discredit the incident. This is apparently well planned, because when Marcel arrived in Fort Worth, he was taken to General Ramey's office with the debris he had brought with him and told to put the packages of the debris on General Ramey's desk. Says Ramey invited Marcel into the map room so he could show the general where the incident happened. When General Ramey and Major Marcel came out of the map room, the debris Marcel had brought with him was no longer on the desk. And in its place was a damaged weather balloon on the floor. Now, when I look at a picture, I don't look for pretty faces. Having myself been in the military, Ramey's statement to Marcel when Marcel questioned him about where the debris was that he had brought with him is to me one of the classics in pulling rank. General Ramey told Major Marcel, "You pose for the pictures and I'll answer the questions." Up until the time of Marcel's death in 1986, he continued to state that the material he posed with for the pictures in General Ramey's office was not the same material he had brought to Fort Worth from Roswell. James Bond Johnson, a reporter for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram newspaper, was summoned to General Ramey's office at Carswell Air Force Base to take the pictures, which he did. However, much later, he also embellished his knowledge and involvement, which two other researchers and I questioned in an interview we did separately with him. Those interviews are posted on my website, truthseeker@roswell.com. I don't think you have to be a nuclear physicist or a brain surgeon to see that the brown paper right here is not anything that was wrapped up. That's off of a brand new roll of brown wrapping paper. On the radiator back here is General Ramey, Major Marcel's hat and necktie. And once again, the expression on Marcel's face tells me that he does not want to be posing for those pictures. I met and interviewed Johnson a few years before he passed away, and there's no doubt that he took the photos in General Ramey's office, but he had also embellished his involvement. One of those pictures is of particular interest to us researchers 60 years later. I'm sure General Ramey didn't realize in 1947 that someday in the future the technology would become available to analyze photographs through computers, enlargements, and other means to possibly hold the general responsible for possibly proving the truth about the Roswell incident. Now, this picture in particular, I want you to look at that piece of paper that General Ramey is holding right there. You really can't tell on the screen, but the type on that piece of paper is facing the camera. And we're starting to read that memo. This gives you a better shot of the brown paper right here. And back here against the wall is that one of them open packages that I was talking about. In this photo, General Ramey is kneeling down on the left. Seated next to him is Colonel Thomas DeBose, Chief of Staff of the 8th Air Force. If you look closely, General Ramey is holding what appears to be a teletype message. And what's important about that teletype is the fact that the writing, the printed type, is facing the camera. This is a two-line enlargement of that teletype message done by researcher David Rudiak. Others have also analyzed the memo, and so far there's agreement in the ufology community that the following words appear on the teletype. The word victims, there are only about 14 words in the English language that have the letters V, two I's, and an S in the same location as victims. And we don't believe violins, Yiddish, yipping, or virgins have anything to do with the Roswell incident. Line 7 mentions a weather balloon believed related to a cover-up story. Would it not be interesting if the man who helped cover up the Roswell incident in 1947, General Ramey, 60 years later would be the same person that might finally reveal what happened near Roswell through a photograph taken years ago? That's an interesting scenario. So General Ramey, probably under instructions from Washington, had the cover-up in place with pictures to prove it. What happened at Roswell a few days ago was not a crash flying saucer, but merely a weather balloon that members of the elite atomic bomb group, the 509th, misidentified. The next morning, July 9th, one day after the newspaper headline of July 8th stated we captured a flying saucer, there was a new headline, authorized by General Ramey, stating General Ramey empties Roswell saucer. This was excuse number two. I have copies of both these newspapers back there at my table I get from the Roswell Daily Record. Good souvenirs. They're full page, front page editions of that, both those newspapers. The cover-up was now firmly in place. People have asked over the years, why was it called the Roswell incident if it happened near Corona, New Mexico? Well, as I explained earlier, the crash site where the debris was discovered by the researcher was referred to as the Corona debris field due to it being close to the town of Corona. But the military being in Roswell, it became the Roswell incident due to the military involvement. With the issuance of General Ramey's statement, the whole incident was pretty much put to rest. And because people back then respected the military and the government, they accepted this excuse, and not much was said or done about the incident until 1978, 31 years later. During those years, there were other reports of sightings worldwide, but Roswell was pretty dormant until a nuclear physicist named Stanton Friedman, interested in propulsion and ufology, was told about a retired Major Jesse Marcel living in Houma, Louisiana. Friedman interviewed Marcel on February 20, 1978, and the investigation of the Roswell incident began again. Other researchers like Berlitz and Moore and a few others got involved. Since then, 100 witnesses have been interviewed, and new names continue to be located and interviewed when possible. So Roswell just won't go away. During Friedman's research in hundreds of libraries and archives, he eventually came upon some documents which he referred to as Majestic 12 or MJ-12 that showed without a doubt that a written policy was in force to cover up anything related to UFOs. Several military projects such as Project Sign, Project Grudge, and I suppose the most popular to the public, Project Blue Book, were done to explain the phenomena of all the sightings before being reported. Project Blue Book, however, most of us believe was nothing more than a way to pacify the public and assure them that there was no threat to our country from UFOs. Several hundred of the thousands of reports investigated under Project Blue Book remain unexplainable to this day. And interestingly, Roswell is not even listed. It was originally believed that Majestic 12 was set up by President Truman as a means of controlling all of the information coming in about flying discs, aliens, etc., as written by Truman to the Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, on June 24, 1947. Some researchers are looking at the possibility that the letter is not authentic and that Truman's signature may have been lifted from an official document. The list of members belonging to the original MJ-12 group is quite impressive. There's several names up there you might recognize. James Forrestal, Secretary of Navy, First Secretary of Defense. Of all the people, of all the information available about the original members of MJ-12, I find the information about James Forrestal to be some of the most interesting, particularly his death. He had been Secretary of the Navy, and in September 1947, President Truman named him the first Secretary of Defense. He resigned in March 1949, but soon hospitalized, analyzed as being mentally unbalanced, prior to supposedly committing suicide. There are still many questions about his death, still unanswered today. Additionally, Majestic 12 documents have surfaced during the recent past, which are currently being analyzed to determine if they are factual, disinformation, or a hoax. The original documents were received at the home of Jamie Shandera, a Los Angeles TV producer and writer, in December 1984 on a roll of unprocessed 35mm film, which when printed revealed what appeared to be photographs of alleged secret documents describing the recovery of a crashed extraterrestrial craft in the New Mexico desert in 1947. Today, the original documents are also being questioned as a possible hoax or disinformation, since code names are normally only used one time and the word magic referred to the cover name used to decipher the Japanese diplomatic code in 1940s. Now, if you have any trouble believing that things such as UFOs involving thousands of people in the cover-up can be kept secret for years, keep in mind that the Manhattan Project involved more than 50,000 people between 1942 and 1945 at a cost of $20 billion in today's money. Breaking the enemy code involved at least 10,000 people, and no word of that got out to the public until 25 years after the war was over. Area 51 in Nevada, which I'll talk about tomorrow, has been in existence as a secret underground base 85 miles northwest of Las Vegas, Nevada, since the 1950s. And the government didn't admit to anything being there until 1995, when an additional 5 to 8,000 acres was acquired for national security. The F-117 stealth fighter we found out about during the Gulf War in 1991. But that technology, planning, and testing went back 20 or 30 years. It's now been taken out of service and replaced with a Raptor. And I can assure you, other aircraft designs are being worked on. Earlier, I set the newspaper headlines of July 8th and July 9th, 1947, for the first two excuses given by the Air Force for what took place near Roswell. The third excuse came out on September 8th, 1994, when the United States Air Force released a 2.5-inch thick report entitled The Roswell Report, Fact versus Fiction in the New Mexico Desert. In this voluminous document, author Colonel Weaver stated that what the Air Force concluded is that what was recovered near Roswell wasn't a flying saucer with alien bodies, nor was it a weather balloon, as General Ramey stated in 1947. Instead, the wreckage probably consisted of balloons, radar reflectors, sonobuoys, and miscellaneous junk from a highly classified Project Mogul balloon assembly. Project Mogul's objective, but not the equipment, which, by the way, was started in 1946 and highly classified, was to develop a constant high-altitude balloon which could monitor sounds produced by a Soviet nuclear explosion thousands of miles away. The first nuclear explosion didn't take place until 1949, 2 years after the Roswell incident. On July 29, 1995, the GAO, General Accounting Office, released their report about Roswell to New Mexico Congressman Stephen Schiff, after he extended requests in several Washington-based departments such as the CIA, the Department of Defense, the FBI, to research records concerning the 1947 Roswell crash. The GAO report stated that numerous records of Roswell Army Airfield, which should have been kept, have been destroyed, which included administrative records from March 1945 through December 1949 and outgoing messages from October 1946 through December 1949. How convenient. Records of the only atomic bomb group in the world in 1947 that dropped the bombs on Japan to end the Second World War were destroyed. What else has been destroyed? Or has it been? The fourth excuse, but if you're a wagering person, probably not the last one, was ironically released 2 weeks before the 50th anniversary of the Roswell incident in June 1997. The Air Force timing was exceptional, since Roswell was getting a lot of coverage for the 50th. The 19-page report by Captain James McAndrew is that it was a balloon dropping dummies. I will not waste your time or mine to go into any detail of this report dealing with the excuses given, that what happened in Roswell was anthropomorphic crash test dummies dropped from balloons. Crash test dummies were not used until 1953, 6 years after this incident happened in 1947. I think the report was an insult to the intelligence of the American people, and even though the report was entitled Case Closed, it's not. Now, was there a cover-up 60 years later? I told you at the beginning of this presentation that I'd share an experience with you that I had in 1977, which I was totally unprepared for. At the time, I was affiliated with the UFO Museum in Roswell as a full-time volunteer and as a UFO investigator. May 27, 1997, a phone call was received from a gentleman in Oklahoma who told me that his dad had just informed him that he had been stationed at Roswell in 1947 as a military policeman. He also stated his dad told him he had been on guard duty at the crash site and guarded the ambulances bringing the bodies back to the base. He said his orders were to shoot anyone that got close to the ambulances. In a later phone interview I had with the elderly gentleman, he told me he didn't know if he could have shot another American, but those were his orders. While at the crash site, he picked up a piece of metal, debris, stuck it in his pocket, and 50 years later, he still had it, but now wanted to get rid of it, telling his son that people would kill over that piece of metal. He and the son were very concerned about confidentiality and safety for the family, which was their reason for calling to see if we wanted the metal. I took 5 pages of notes talking to the father as he explained his duties at Roswell and the fact that he had recently been diagnosed with terminal cancer with 6 months to live. Several calls were made between the son and I from my residence to set up a meeting for me to drive to Oklahoma, meet the father, get the medal, and hopefully interview him if the family agreed to that. I drove to Oklahoma on June 13, 1997. Tried to contact the son at the phone number I'd been given in order to set up a meeting time for the next day, and was told by a woman that answered the phone that he was out of town on an emergency. The next day, I laid around the hotel all day, calling the son 3 times and getting a recording each time. By 2:30, I figured it was a hoax and a wasted trip. At 3:30, my phone rang at the hotel, and a woman said, "Meet him at Denny's restaurant at 7 o'clock. I went to Denny's, and a man and woman walked in, fitting the clothing description I had been given on the phone. He said, "Are you Dennis?" I said, "Yes." And we sat down in a booth. The first thing he told me was, "The gentleman you plan on meeting will not be at this meeting." I said, "Who are you?" And he said, "We're special agents of the United States Air Force Office of Special Investigation out of Dallas, and we answer directly to Langley, Virginia." I don't need to go into a lot of detail on how I felt when I was told I wouldn't meet who I came to see, and that they were with the Air Force. I asked him, "How do you know I was coming Monday, you'd be here Friday?" I says, "My phone tapped." He smiled and looked at me and said, "You know how we do business." I spent 3.5 hours with these two people I had never met before, discussing the piece of metal that I was supposed to get, the Roswell incident, Area 51, a lot of other things related to ufology. He had a New Mexico map. We talked about the crash sites, and he had drawings of UFOs. I didn't take any notes during that meeting, so when I got back to the hotel, I made as many notes on a cassette recorder as I could remember. And on the drive back to Roswell the next day, I wrote notes on a pad. I remembered things we had discussed. I came back to Roswell empty-handed, never got the medal or met the son or father. 2 days after returning home, I called the son to find out what had gone wrong, as I felt betrayed since we had an agreement on confidentiality. The son was very nervous on the phone and didn't want to talk because he said, "There's still someone here." At which time another voice came on the phone informing me he was another agent that had flown in from Langley. That phone call lasted about 20 minutes. A few weeks later, I called again, missed the son, and asked that he call me back collect. He never called back. Then on December 26, 1997, I called again, as I had checked with the phone company to see who the phone in Oklahoma was listed to, and I believe I talked to the female agent. I had her on the phone about 10 minutes, putting a lot of pressure on her, when a male voice came on the line and said, "If you keep messing with the Air Force OFI office, you're barking up the wrong alley. Click." That was a threat, and that was the last contact I had. This was under investigation for 12 years with the help of researcher Frank Warren, Stanton Friedman. Several Freedom of Information Act requests were submitted by the Air Force and Congress by Larry Bryant, but no response from either the Air Force or Congress. The possibility of a hoax or of a sit-up or scam was always a possibility. And if that was the case, someone had broken some serious laws by impersonating federal agents, interstate telephone violations, not providing proper identification, and invading my privacy. I dealt with 5 or 6 different individuals over a 6-month period. That's a big hoax, and what was their motive? If they were real agents, we still had a cover-up very much in place 50 years later in 1997. And there wasn't any weather balloon with crash test dummies that came down near Roswell. Through the diligent work of Frank Warren and myself and several others, it was discovered that the interception was a setup and that the individual responsible had done several other similar scams on other individuals. For me personally, it was a real experience for a period of time and eventually accomplished nothing to help resolve the Roswell incident. But it does show teamwork and perseverance and good research can accomplish things in time. Being able to finalize a part of my research, not with the end results expected or hoped for, but with finalization. And you don't get that very often when you're doing this research. So it took us 12 years. I would have liked to file a lawsuit against them for impersonating federal agents, but statute of limitations had run out. When this first went down, I didn't know how to handle it. I wasn't prepared for it. And I honestly believed that they were real agents based on the information we had. And I talked to Stanton about this, and he told me, he said, go public. And he said, if you go public and something happens, we know what it was about. And I didn't realize how important that was at the time, but I did. I did a lecture at the UFO Museum with over 200 people present. And when I got through, it was like something was lifted off my shoulders, because there it was. It was out. And it took us 12 years to finally get to the bottom of it. Why someone would do that, something like that, I don't know. But I lost 18 pounds in 3 months. I put tape over the hood of my truck, an old police trick. And if the tape's torn in the morning, you don't start your truck. But it was an experience for me that I'll never forget. So there you have the Roswell incident from my perspective. I've tried to give you some history about UFOs, an overview of some of the events pertaining to the 1947 incident, and particularly some of the witnesses and their statements. I've also given you some of the investigation going on and shared my personal experience with you. You can't possibly cover 60 years of history and research in this brief explanation. But if you came here knowing nothing about the incident, and my hope, you believe a little better informed. If you already knew about it, maybe I shed a different light on it than you heard before. As an investigator, researcher, lecturer, or journalist, I don't permit myself to ask you to believe it. That's your decision. I can, however, tell you that something happened 60 years ago near Roswell, New Mexico, in July 1947, that many of us believe is still covered up by the government, and we want to know the truth. Now, before I totally complete this presentation, how many of you have ever heard of the Aztec crash in Aztec, New Mexico? Most people don't know anything about it. 10 months after Roswell happened, March of 1948, there was a crash. Actually, it wasn't a crash. It was pretty much a landing of a 99-foot craft with 13 bodies that came down on a mesa in Hart Canyon, 8 miles east of Aztec, New Mexico, which is up near Farmington. There have been two books written about it. Both books are controversial. Scott Ramsey from North Carolina and his wife Suzanne. Scott was out there in the area and heard about it and thought, well, I'm going to look into this. And he said, a couple months, I'll have it resolved. 26 years later, Scott has a book out. I have copies back there. I think Stanton has some copies worth selling for Scott and his wife. It's one of the best books I've ever read on a UFO crash. But there were oil field workers present at the time. There were law enforcement people. There was a pastor there in case he was needed. And they actually crawled on the craft, looked inside, and saw the body slumped over what looked like a panel and burned. So it appears that the craft had some kind of internal problem, because unlike Roswell, which was debris scattered over a field, this was an intact craft. Scott's gone to the detail of figuring out how they could have transported it, and even had somebody who is familiar with equipment back in the 1940s. It's a well-done book, and I would highly recommend it if you have a chance. So I'd like to conclude with a quote I like to use. Always telling the truth means never having to remember anything. Thank you. Good question. I get this a lot. She wants to know who were these people that threatened me in Oklahoma. Were they black ops people? My main interest is what was their motive. Why? Why let me drive all the way to Oklahoma and meet me? Why not just let me drive and not show up if it's going to be a hoax? But I spent 3.5 hours with these people, a man and a woman. She didn't say much. But according to the way we got to the bottom of it was through the woman. Turns out she was the guy's ex-wife and told us that he had done this before to other people. So I guess this is the way he got his kicks. I don't know. It was a hoax, yeah. But for me, it was real when it happened. Because for quite a while, I really believed that I was dealing with real people, that were real Air Force, there wasn't really a guy that had a piece of metal. And I talked to intelligence people. They said if I'd have got the medal, I'd have never got back to Roswell, which wasn't too reassuring either. But it was an experience, and I've learned from it. If I ever have an opportunity again to do such a thing, I will not be by myself, probably. I may be armed. I may protect myself some way. Because I don't think there's any limit. Stanton may not agree with this, but I don't think there's any limit to how far our military and our government will go to shut people up. We have information where they've done that, changed names, relocated people, and things like that. I should turn around and salute this guy back here. I don't have much good to say about military. Okay, I'm going to be back here tomorrow at 9 o'clock if you can get up that early, and we're going to look at Area 51. Thank you.